dot, dot, dot. We usually call that mode consciousness very glibly in our time. But probably a better description is to use the phrase that the great William James used, which was quite accurate. William James, very, very accurate. Stream of consciousness. And you could even use this kind of a phrase, that the stream of consciousness flows through a field of experience. And as it does, it generates an electromagnetic energeia. And as it does that, we are able to think. So that thought is very, very powerful but exact occurrence in this universe. An electroencephalograph will record that there are definite patterns to thought, energy patterns, which can be recorded. They're not so minute that they don't exist. It's not just a fantasy and so forth. The patterns of thought are the patterns of language. So that language is not just an approximation of thought, but language is the amplified worldly form by which thought occurs. One can go into this quite deeply, as you can see. But in the classic art of memory, it was important to realize that a structure was needed to place the images. And as one placed the images in the structure, one also learned to use words that one would speak out loud, and yet in a deeper, more esoteric level, words that one would think silently. And that this whole transformation process, this whole high magic tied up with the art of memory, eventually used as the grand symbolic structure by which the arrangement happened, symbolic architecture, like the Temple of Solomon. Built to exactly provide a place where training of communication with the divine could take place. To think that someone would go to all of that trouble just to have a place to offer sacrifices is to misunderstand. If it's a quality of piling gold upon gold, well, then the more the better. But it wasn't. It was a question of building exactly in the right proportions so that the experience of being there in God's house would train one so that one would see from birth, from initiation of the community all through one's life, one would be able to see a graphic presentation of the form by which the mind is made correctly. And even if you did not have the full training which priesthood would have, you would have access to that mind on a subconscious level, even on an associative level. And one would know then how to hear rightly, how to see rightly, and be able to be taught. One thing that distinguished ancient human beings from contemporary human beings, that ancient human beings were educable. Modern human beings, for the most part, are uneducable. It doesn't matter how long you spend with them. They cannot learn. They're like wolf children who have never learned a language, and if you haven't learned some language by the age of 9, you can never learn a language. That capacity is blown. And most modern human beings are like wolf children in terms of their spiritual development. They can't hear. They can't see. It doesn't matter how much energy you put into it, how accurate you are, they won't hear or see anything. There's no way to respond, unless, of course, one just bypasses the whole person and you go to a deep self, but there's no correlation with the person, and so they experience it as if, oh, well, somebody else is speaking. Someone else higher than me is seeing. And you can see that it's just endemic in our time. Most people don't understand. It's not someone else that's seeing, someone else that's speaking through you. You are speaking through you. You know this, not X, Y, or Z from someplace else. It's you who know this. Ergo, it's you who are this universal capacity. So take care with what you do, etc. And you can see that this is extremely powerful for patients in our time to know that most people are uneducable. And not to exhaust yourself in trying to help or force feed people who are just are unable to receive it. Help those who come to you because they will recognize in what you do. Keep your integrity in what you do and they'll come. You can help them that way. The art of memory used architecture, sacred architecture for this kind of arrangement, so that the earliest art form that we have for human beings is architecture in the arrangement of images and architecture. Before there's any sculpture, before there's any poetry, before there's any painting, really, is architecture. In the history of sacred architecture, Stonehenge is recent. The caves of Lascaux and Altamira are at least 20 to 25,000 years ago. So there are all kinds of ways to understand this. But the basic thing is, for memory to work, there has to be a dimension like sacred architecture within which it can work. One then places the images that one wishes to recall, one wishes to know, into the arrangement of the sacred architecture. Now you can do it when you're young, when you're a child or a young person, by going into the physical building, because you don't know the building yet. And so you have to memorize the building. How do these come together? How does that portion out? How many of these are there? That sort of thing. And it's a mystical initiation to be carried into that kind of a dimension. It's preparing you. It's giving you what in the art of memory was called the, it's like the whole repertoire of the wax tablets, where you can record everything. And it's a very esoteric process. One of the few people who was ever initiated in this archetypal ancient way in modern times was William Blake. And when William Blake was 15 years old, his father had enough sense to realize that Blake was an unusual boy and needed to be someplace in the arts. But being practical, apprenticed him to an engraver, someone who engraved plates. And that engraver, in an almost miraculous kind of miracle, placed the young teenage William Blake in a building which he was required to train himself and also to earn his keep by producing engravings of every single detail of that building for the engraver, who could then use those engravings, those details, in his own work. That building was Westminster Abbey. And William Blake, throughout all of his adolescence, spent every day, about 10 hours a day, engraving every goddamn detail of Westminster Abbey. And after 5 or 6 years, he could see. He could look in his mind's eye at whatever he wanted to know, and the structures were in place, and it just came naturally. And Blake was one of the few people in modern times who was like a classic ancient seer, perfected in the art of memory, in the art of transmutative structure. And so by the time Blake was 21, he not only was free from his apprenticeship to the engraver, he was free from the whole society, from the whole civilization. He didn't belong anymore in the place that someone had put him, but he belonged wherever he wanted to be, and was quite somebody. The use of sacred architecture could not only be a building, but if one has the building in the mind, it was discovered as early as ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago that the true building is in the mind. The arrangement of the building is in the mind, but the structure that holds that building up is in the spirit, the deep self, as we would call it today. So that the building of the Egyptian pyramids, of the tombs, is not to bury the dead. Those pyramids were built in the lifetime of the people, during the whole lifetime. They were built for the living, so that they would not die. Because when one arranges one's mind in this way and activates the deep self, there is no death. There's rebirth. So this entire tradition, the use of high magic in every culture, in every form, has this kind of a key to it. The activation of the deep self is intimately tied up into the process of remembering, which is a function of the mind ordered, which makes the person real. And that entire ecology cannot be separated. There's no way to piecemeal it out. There's no way to have a workshop on being a person in any way without bringing in the entire ecology. So it all has to be, quote, taught together, or not at all. To teach it separately is to promote illusion, and is definitely not to be done. We better take a break. The cards are here, and you're free to read this card from Ron Moore. And I might just remind some of you who may not realize or recognize that the work that I'm doing on Tuesday nights is really deep self-restructuring on a rather massive scale. And if you get interested at all, this book published just a year ago by Oxford University Press, Greek Rhetorical Origins of Christian Faith, is just the beginning of an intellectual recognition and a move to understand that somehow the classical rhetorical shape of the mind had something intimate to do with the nature of Jesus, and that before there was a Christianity, there was someone who was indeed masterfully able to restructure the mind in such a way that the deep self was available in a new and refreshed way. And I think that if you get any kind of insight at all, it doesn't matter what religious background you have, the Tuesday nights are, I think, important. Just put it at that. They're important. in Francis Yates's work, and I want to just carry you through this and bring you into another work, which I would use if it were not just overloading you. Let me go through Francis Yates's chapter 2 as far as I got. When I get more paper, I'll finish Xeroxing this and give everybody a copy of it. If you can, get yourself a copy of the book, The Art of Memory. She writes here, "The artificial memory, that is artificial in the sense that it was artificial in that they thought that training was a surface arrangement. But of course the artificial memory is, quote, artificial. When the surface arrangement is learned, all by its own self, it reveals a depth. And that depth shows that the arrangement pattern is not just from your worldly experience, but is in parallel. The parallel is as above, so below. That there is a structural arrangement." So she writes here, "The artificial memory is established from places and images, the stock definition to be repeated down through the ages. A locus is a place easily grasped by the memory, such as a house, an inner columnar space, a corner, an arch, or the like. Images are forms, marks, or simulacra of what we wish to remember. For instance, if we wish to recall the genus of a horse, of a lion, of an eagle, we must place their images on definite places, definite loci. The art of memory is like an inner writing. Those who know the letters of the alphabet can write down what is dictated to them and read out what they have written. Likewise, those who have learned mnemonics can set in places what they have heard and deliver it from memory." And this development deepens the mind. The mind deepens so that the thought, the pattern of the thought process, the structure of thinking itself becomes like a penetrating form. And I guess the time-honored metaphor is that it sinks to the center. Or, if you like, which is the same thing, it rises to the apex. The self can be seen either as an apex, the God without, or the God within. It doesn't really make any difference. In fact, in the best of the teachings, both processes happen at the very same time. So that one understands now that this arrangement that one has learned is effective on any level, in any dimension whatsoever. So that chapter 2 of her book is entitled The Art of Memory in Greece, Memory and the Soul. So that memory has everything to do with the soul. Everything. And again, I must emphasize to you, it doesn't make any difference what background you come from. This form is universal. It makes no difference whatsoever. She writes here, one of the few sources we have of Simonides is the life of Simonides written by Plutarch. Plutarch in the first century was a masterful priest of the high mysteries in Greece. He's a contemporary of the Roman historian Tacitus. The phrase used in ancient times, ut pictura poesis. That is to say, you juxtapose picture and poetry together. So that Plutarch says, painting is silent poetry, and poetry is painting that speaks. For the actions which painters depict as they are being performed, words described after they are done. So that the art of memory is the key of all art. Art as a cultural phenomenon is a happening in amplitude of the working of the process of memory. And the archetypal art was architecture. For instance, Frank Lloyd Wright used to write about architecture being the mother of the arts. And it's a kind of, in parallel, saying memory is the mother of the muses. All artistic experience has to do with the process of bringing the memory process to its culmination. Its culmination is the revealing of the deep self and the person. So that art has to do with person making and the development of remembering the soul. So that in a way, any real art is really a sacred art. They're not disparate at all. The making of art a worldly vanity is a serious error based on a mythological understanding of consciousness, and indeed dominated European civilization in what was called the Dark Ages. And the rediscovery that this was not so was indeed quite a shock. It was rediscovered by the abbot of the abbot Suger at the Saint-Denis in Paris in the 12th century. It was rediscovered that art has an expressive purpose for manifesting what we would call today the deep self and for establishing the person. So that you have a renaissance in the 12th century of the rediscovery of the person, the importance of the person. And concomitant to that, you have all sorts of great visionaries who understand through their seeing that God is a person, that for us in this world, God is a person. And it's not a doctrinaire standpoint at all, but it's something that the inner eye or the inner ear comes to understand, that your person at this exactness and dimension is the correct presentation of God in this world. And out of this came a whole development that eventually became like when it was reformulated in doctrine of position, the cult of the saints came up. And the use of magical ceremonies like the Eucharist in Christianity became the focus of a magical transmutation. Before that, it had been rather doctrinaire as a ritual. After that, it became high magic formulation. All of this happened in the 12th century. I'm saying to you in a brief thing, before the 12th century, Christianity was totally different from what it was afterwards. The difference between the 1100s and the 1300s is monumental. They're two different religions, really. Totally different. But what's interesting here is that where does this come from? It doesn't come from Christianity. By the time Christianity receives it, it's already old as the hills. We say conveniently, well, it comes from the Greeks. And where in the Greeks? Well, it isn't just Simonides. The real genius at expressing it was Pythagoras. But Pythagoras never claimed to have it. Where did he get it? He got it from the Egyptians. And one can follow it back from there. And the earliest writings that we have from Egypt, the pyramid texts from 3000 BC, already show that the whole process is understood. It's already sophisticatedly presented as if it were ancient wisdom 5,000 years ago. Anyone who understands this, the Egyptian text would say, understands that it has always been this way. It has never not been this way. So that tradition is like a lineage which, for all intents and purposes, for human purposes, has occurred as a realization concomitant with the existence of our species. Wherever human beings have occurred, they have occurred with this golden thread of capacity intact, complete, in them. We can't go through all of this, but there are many indications that even pre-Homo sapiens sapiens, hominid forms, had at least the rudiments of this capacity. Memory becomes memory not just for things, but for images. But not just for things and for images, but for words. And notice that the word controls the image which restructures the thing. But what controls the word? The divine within. So that one has an alignment that happens. It's like what Frank Lloyd Wright would call the center line of the building. Any building that stays up because its structure is arranged in such a way that the center line of that building is well-founded. The center line of a building is like the spinal column of a physical body. The whole skeletal structure is made to coordinate itself around that axis. I'm sure that you've all heard the term, the architecture of the soul. Everyone is familiar with that kind of a term. Or the term that's become popularized in the last decade or so, the temple of the mind. The structure of the mind as a sacred structure has a center line. And that center line is that alignment, then, of bringing the things of this world and their images into alignment with the words that structure them with the speaker. She within who speaks. And that this alignment then is, in every avenue where it is aligned, a primordial radiant occurrence of reality. That is what is real. On just the level of this world, the things are constantly shifting and changing. So that the term for nature in all early sophisticated languages, Sanskrit, Greek, Chinese, whatever the term for nature meant, that which changes. It's not there. It's only there temporarily. The Greek term for nature was physis, which means literally emerging. And everywhere that we have this, in India, the Sanskrit term for nature, prakriti, means that it's in the process of happening. what is real is that that happening, that emerging, that concourse of change does not happen in a chaotic way, but happens according to a structural sequencing. Once one knows the structural sequencing, once one gets the images in the structural sequencing, the things will follow whatever that sequence is. And the words, once one gets the sequencing of the words right, the images are going to follow. And the things of this world will follow that. But the real point, the real center, is the divine within. If that's not operative, those lines, that geometry of the real is not well founded. Then it's dependent on whether conditions externally hold or not. And if they hold externally for a long time, you might be duped into thinking, well, that's good enough. But the fact is that eventually they change. Eventually even the Great Pyramids of Giza will just be dust again. So you can't found it on the world. And in fact, it's ignorant to try and do that. There's no substitute for getting the center line right. Then whatever is done is done with that confidence of reality. So that the very earliest things, reading from Francis Yates now, in this earliest Ars Memorativa, the Arts of Memory, in this earliest treatise of the Art of Memory, the images for words are formed from primitive etymological dissection of the word. In the examples given of images for things, the things virtue and vice are represented, valor and cowardice. Also, the various arts like metallurgy. They are deposited in memory with images of gods and men, Mars, Achilles, Vulcan. Here we may perhaps see in an archaically simple form these human figures representing things which eventually developed into the imaginative agents. And then you have with Montaigne's tarot deck, if you've looked at the various images, you have a culmination of this great tradition in this form, so that in this little box of images is the architectural plan in symbolic form of the classical mind, rediscovered in the 15th century. And quite accurately, incidentally. The High Renaissance in northern Italy is very accurate. They were not fools. But the presentation of it classically had been hidden, had been occulted, as it were, through ignorance. So that in the Renaissance, not in the 15th century, but in the 13th century, that phase of the Renaissance, it was rediscovered that the structure, the logical structure of thinking, had everything to do with the way in which the mind was formed. And of course, one of the great figures in this was Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas understood that the form of the mind, the logical form of the mind, if founded upon the interior experience of the divine, would then order the placement of imagery and transform the world accordingly. In foundational works that he used Aristotle mainly, but one of the foundational works of Aristotle that he used was the Topics. And the very word that comes down to us now, topic. What is a topic? We just in a colloquial way, we call it the subject that you're going to talk about, right? The topic is the subject. Notice the connection of subjects as what you're going to talk about with the subject in, or the subjective, the inner state. Notice the correlation. It's just the same way that the topics of Aristotle, the Greek word, is not topics, but topoi, which are places. So the subjects that we're going, subject is related to place. Place is in the art of memory, where the images are going to go. See the correlation between the subjective and the placement. Between, if I can put it in this language, the sacred temple and the worshiper. They're like in a parallel. And in any correct wisdom tradition, they're like a tuning fork that, when they're in parallel and you strike that with actual experience, that experience is true. And it reverberates wherever experience can register the truth of that. The right worshiper in the right temple is heard by God, is the way that it would have been said. Where's that right temple? That right temple can be built, and then that temple can provide a place. But conditions change. Temples, even the greatest of the temples, have fallen, have vanished. But the inner temple of the mind is not fallen, is not vanished. It's fallen in terms of the egotistical personality. And in fact, if you get to certain depth of transformation, there's a characteristic dream image that comes up of a smashed castle or a smashed house or a destroyed city. It's like a symbolic archetypal image of the ruined, what once was a correct worldly expression is now is ruined. The world is in ruins. The image of the once beautiful temple is in ruins. And if you are stuck on that, there is immeasurable, pitiable grief attached to that. If you lament the ruined relics in the world, which were once accurate and excellent expressions, there is endless grief and pity. The proverbial wall of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem is a wailing wall. But the temple within has never been ruined. It's never been destroyed. It's still there. What collapses is the egotistical approximation of it. And that house within, that image of that house within that can be crushed, one should not depend on that anyway. That's not a place to live, much less to worship. Or to put it the other way, it's not a place to worship, much less to live. But there is an architecture within which is uncrushable and never crushes. It never is in ruins. It always is together. When one enters that, that is called, and notice the Renaissance term for it, the Palace of Wisdom. That building within is the Palace of Wisdom. And it is there. There's no way for it not to be there. Because it is, in effect, the very accurate structure itself by which consciousness comes to realize that symbolic. So that it's like the best example, I think, that's still extant in our world is in the floor of major Gothic cathedrals, but especially the example I always love to use is the floor of Chartres Cathedral, right in the center of it. is a maze, a labyrinth. That to get to the center of that labyrinth, one has to cross the entire volume of the maze. When one does that, one realizes it is not a maze, it is a pattern. It's not a labyrinth of lostness, but it is an experience of achieving fullness. That what you thought was wandering was really journeying. The very same activity. What you thought was blundering around in anxiety was the exact achievement of the real. And what had seemed a labyrinth before is now seen as the very pattern of wholeness. The very pattern of wholeness was not different from the labyrinth of the journey that you went through. And in fact, the etymology of the word labyrinth is just quite accurate. A labyrinth doesn't mean a maze, it means the royal palace. That's what it means in archaic Greek. The labyrinth was the double axe, which is still was the symbol of the place of royalty in ancient, not in classical Greek times, but ancient Greek times. Before Greek was written in Greek, it was written in what is called Linear B. And before that, in Linear A. That is 1,500 years before Pythagoras was born. Before he was born, already the double axe, the labyrinth, was associated with the royal palace, and the ancient name, the Greek name for palace in archaic Greek, was rinth. So the labyrinth was the royal palace. And it met archetypally the palace of Knossos on Minos, or the palace of Minos and Knossos on Crete, which had 3,000 rooms, and to somebody coming in from little villages, which is about all there was really in the world at that time, a royal palace of 3,000 rooms was, in a colloquial sense, a labyrinth. But the whole meaning of it is that this is the palace within. The labyrinth is the palace within of that royal self who you really are. You really are. But that doesn't occur, you don't remember that until this whole process has been gone through, until the path of confusion has been transformed by comprehension into the pattern of the cosmos. That whole process is a remembering process. Just to go through it and not realize that one is going through it is like placing oneself like a gerbil on a little wheel of destiny, little wheel of fortune. You just keep running the goddamn wheel, just like the little gerbils do, and it doesn't go anywhere. But that same wheel that binds you to infinite purposeless direction by the transmutation of exactness becomes the Dharma chakra, becomes the wheel of truth. One realizes that that activity which is cognized then transmutes into a recognition. One recognizes this is the pattern. And one is able to step free from that. The pattern, instead of being a prison wherein one is kept like some kind of content for someone else's form, that form becomes, the prison becomes the very form by which one is freed. And one is no longer a content for someone else's forms, but you are your own subject for your own form. And it's this kind of an occurrence. So that the there could be no doubt, writes Francis Yates, that these topoi, used by persons with a trained memory, must be the mnemonic loci, the places. And it is indeed probable that the very word topics, as used in dialectics, arose through the places of mnemonics. So the whole development of dialectic, of logic, is all tied up with the getting correct the topics or the subject within the correct places. Topics are the things or subject matter of dialectic which came to be known as topoi through the places in which they were stored. In the De Insomnis, that's Aristotle's book on dreams, in the De Insomnis, Aristotle says that some people have